Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. Each week, Matt, Kurt, Jerry, and the occasional special guest explore how the trauma-informed paradigm challenges traditional beliefs and approaches concerning a wide variety of areas. This podcast addresses psychological trauma in an educational manner and is not designed to replace mental health treatment. If anything in this podcast makes you feel uncomfortable or anxious, please talk to a mental health professional.
The Trauma Informed Lens podcast. My name is Matt Bennett. I'm here again with Jerry and Kurt for another episode. Today we're going to talk about a fascinating topic that has really, again, one of those things with the trauma informed paradigm that's really made me rethink my role as both a therapist and somebody that looks at healing from a lot of different perspective, and that's intergenerational trauma. If you've not heard about this research, stay tuned, because I really think it puts our work in a different context. It puts trauma not just as an experience in one space and time, but that can be transmitted and influence generations going forward. And so we'll look at a little bit of the research on intergenerational trauma, which I think we would all agree is an evolving field. This gets us into the cutting edge of genetics and psychology, and also neurobiology as well. So it's one of those things that if we revisit this topic in 5 years, we will probably have new and exciting research to present then, but some really cool stuff coming out of these areas. So we're going to tackle that topic today. I always like to say, when I say intergenerational trauma, also there's the concept of intergenerational resiliency as well, that while this can sort of on the surface be a pretty depressing topic when I first heard about it, There's some real hope there, and I think inspiration as well. So, as in all weeks, we start our episodes out with our bright, shiny object of the week, which is basically what we're obsessing about this week. And so I'll get us started here as usual. My bright, shiny object of the week, it's kind of just a feel-good thing that I had this morning, actually, and I've been working hard due to kind of an obsession that I've had lately with how do we talk about these concepts with the folks that are in our services. I've had a few opportunities over the last couple years to really, when people have me out to talk to and train their staff, they have me either stay an extra day or come in a day early and do a presentation to the folks that are in their services. I've done this in housing programs, substance abuse, mental health programs. A lot. I've done a couple with school districts I'm working with. I've done parent education on trauma. And I've just really found that the number one piece of feedback I get, which from a therapist is just, you know, somewhat overwhelming to hear, especially if I only have 90 minutes or so with these folks, is, I understand for the first time in my life that I'm not a bad person, which from a therapeutic perspective, if I'm just doing individual work with somebody, you know, in my experience, that could take sometimes months to get to that point. And obviously I'm not curing people in 90 minutes, but you know, I think something about training people and talking about trauma, as much as it's had an impact on the three of us, there's also a real opportunity there to educate the folks that are in services as well. And so my sort of bright, shiny object of the week is I got the first draft done to a supplement to my book, Connecting Paradigms, really written from kind of a workbook perspective of I found when I was writing a book, and it was my first book, and so my learning curve was crazy steep. And I tried to put all these analogies into the book that I use in my trainings. And my wife, who was my first reader on the book, said, "I am so confused. You have, you know, you have cups in there. You have hero's journey in there. You have something about an elephant in there. And I just can't keep track of all your analogies." So to make the book actually understandable, I cut a whole bunch of those out and have been working on putting those back together into a supplement that I hope people can use that are listening to the podcast to really maybe structure group interactions, to do trainings themselves, to help people through analogies understand trauma. So I realized with the first book that you get your first draft done and you think you're almost done, but you're only halfway done. But hey, I hit the halfway point. And if you're looking for a good Christmas gift for that loved one, I hopefully will have it out by Christmas. So that's kind of my feel good, bright, shiny object of the week. Jerry, what are you thinking about this week?
Well, my bright, shiny object is both tragedy and inspiration. And that is the incident that occurred in Las Vegas. And so one of the questions I had is, actually there was two questions that came up for me. One was, why are we so violent? What drives us, right? Because really an individual is a symptom of something much larger. And we like to kind of point to the gun and we like to try to find meaning, but there's something about that. But in the midst of all that, I read an article and I actually heard an interview of a gentleman that was there that saved 30 people and got shot twice. And needed to be actually pulled out and rescued himself. And what it raised a question for me was, if our brain's primary job is survival, then what would drive somebody to risk their lives for people that he doesn't even know? Mm-hmm. And really, in those times of great stress, do we lose some separation between ourselves and others, and we become part of this larger network that it's about survival of our clan or survival of it really raised some really important questions about our humanity for me, that in a way is inspiring me. I want to go read something about what would drive somebody to counteract our own personal survival for the welfare of others. And I think, you know, as we think about all the people that listen, and in some ways we understand that exposure to trauma leads to secondary trauma, and so that is what drives us to give up our own sense of well-being sometimes to heal other people and help them to kind of do it. So lots of questions coming to me out of the news and the media the last couple of weeks.
Absolutely. And I think that, am I right that you wrote, I think it was at Denver Children Advocacy Center, after one of these shootings, unfortunately, this isn't an outlier anymore, something about talking to your kids about trauma.
Yeah, it should be on the advocacy's website, or there's, if it's still up there, or on my website, which is goldcreek.com.
Great. I just remember reading that and thought it was I know I forwarded that to a bunch of people as well. So we'll look for that and stick that in the show notes too. Just a reminder, I wrote about this on my blog too. And I don't know, it's one of those things that, you know, it's just so frustrating because it just seems to keep happening. And we, you know, whether you look at long-term solutions, like getting mental health services for me in schools, which is right now, unfortunately, being cut, so we can address the mental health issues or the gun control issues. And, you know, I wish I had all the answers to the questions, but the one thing I just want to remind everybody too, as we're going through Houston and Puerto Rico, and you know, I saw on the news, I don't know why I watch the news in the morning anymore, there's another hurricane coming up. And, you know, it's just, you know, take care of yourselves. You know, I realize I'm not sleeping. And I want to sleep, and I'm doing a lot of really good self-care. But I just think that, I think when we're in this field, we feel people's pain and suffering in very real ways. And so it's a reminder to take care of ourselves and focus on the great work that we're doing as we help, you know, take care of others and help them in their lives. So real challenging times.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll definitely link that article because I thought that was a really good thing that I know I passed on a few years back. So, Kurt?
There are two narratives that I hear coming out of the news stories I hear from Las Vegas, and true of any big event that I've watched news coverage on. And the first story is how horrible it was.
Yeah.
That's the first narrative that you usually hear. And I actually, with this one, had some thoughts about how quickly the second narrative start, which is the stories of connection that happen as a result of it. And I always hear those two.
Yeah.
And it is interesting that I think I heard that very, very quickly in the news coverage of the Las Vegas event, is how quickly people started talking about people saving others, people risking themselves for others. It made me think of it too while you were talking, Matt, about you get 90 minutes sometimes with somebody, and sometimes you get less than that. Sometimes you get a moment in time.
Yeah.
And how much power you can get out of human connection. And that is really kind of the positive side of understanding a trauma-informed lens is that, and we were talking just a little earlier about one of my opinions about program design is that they should all be tied to an evidence-based practice.
Mm-hmm.
But no amount of evidence base will make up for the dysfunction of relationships on the effectiveness of an evidence-based practice. That's what will make it or break it, is your connection with others. And I think that's certainly my bright, shiny object of the week, is seeing the power of human connection. And thinking of people I've talked to this week and people who do the work with individuals with trauma, and how much they put themselves at risk to do that, right? There's a lot of challenge that comes with hearing about people's stories and the tragedies that you hear about and live with, and to be able to be with people who've been through that and help them through that can certainly, it stress people out. And it's a part of our business that I think is really important for us to recognize and take care of ourselves and take care of others as well. So
yeah, absolutely.
Certainly things I've been thinking about this week.
Absolutely. And it really, in many ways, I think all of this, and again, we record this about a week or to a week and a half before they're published. So, right now, Puerto Rico just is, on my mind. And I mentioned this the other week too, I've trained in Puerto Rico, I've trained in Vegas, I've trained in Houston, all within the last few years. And so, I have friends there, and they may be professional friends, but, there's this caring there, and you see this tremendous amount of trauma, as well as, again, some of that amazing, the stories of heroes running into the fire, which, again, from a neurobiological perspective, is a little bit hard to explain. We have these traumatic events, and a lot of times when we think about trauma, and this kind of goes back, and it might be helpful if you didn't listen to the episode of what is trauma, and when we talked about the big T and the small T trauma, these big T traumas. And one of the things that I've seen in the research is that if there's a outreach of community support, that's when I call it rapid post-traumatic growth, is that we know some people bounce back quicker from especially some of those big T traumas. Mm-hmm. And I think this outpouring of support's really critical, making sure that we continue to have that support, because I can't remember the last time I've seen Houston in the news. And granted, our news cycles are so intense that, something a week ago seems like a year ago. But really looking at a lot of these, we've got these big T traumas, but we also have, as we know, and we've worked with a lot of kids and kids that then turn into adults later on in their life, who their trauma happens behind closed doors in their family situation, that it's secret and there's not this rush of community support. And so when we think about all these different kinds of traumas, whether it's the people in Vegas, in Puerto Rico, or I think a lot of times those hidden victims that we don't see, a lot of times we think about trauma as happening in a time and place. And if there's kind of a start, there's kind of a stop. And then hopefully if everything happens right from a societal level or a system level, then hopefully healing happens in some ways and that person gets support and services. When we start to look at intergenerational trauma, one of the things that was incredibly powerful for me, again, looking at how our genes are expressed, as we talked about epigenetics last time, is that if the healing doesn't happen, that there's a good chance that trauma gets passed on to the offsprings of that person. And I just want to kind of review the science that I've seen around this, put it out to both of you to add any additional stuff that you've seen that I might not have seen. But when we look at and bringing in the epigenetic expression, as we talked about in the last episode, we now know that, again, we think about DNA in different ways. One is chromosomal DNA, which makes up about 2% of our overall DNA. That sort of accounts for the most part our eye color, our hair color, why I'm freakishly tall, you know, those sort of things. The things that we used to just say when we saw it said DNA, we were really talking about chromosomal DNA. Then there's the 98% of our DNA, which is non-coded DNA, which can express itself differently in response to environmental situations. And this is a lot of times responsible for a lot of how our brain structures to survive and thrive in different environments that we might find ourselves in. Obviously, trauma has a huge impact on if we're growing up or we're living in traumatic situations, that's going to really express our genetics in a way, the survival part of our DNA, to really survive those situations, sometimes at the expense of our ability to emotionally regulate ourselves or engage intellectually in things. And so we take that we talked about last episode, and then, you know, the research that I see coming out, and part of this is animal research, part of this is human research, but what I see coming out of the research is powerful in a couple different ways. And the best way I know how to explain this is to look at, to go back to the sperm and the egg, and how trauma can actually be transferred from generation to generation. What I've learned from what happens with the sperm is, I'm not going to do a sex education 101 on this podcast, but sperm is created throughout life. And so what we see is that if the father is going through highly stressful situations or trauma, or as we talked about that small t trauma, that they're surviving things like homelessness, extreme poverty, war, that's going to impact how the DNA is set to express itself in the sperm. And my understanding of that is basically it's set up to express very similar traits as the father needs to survive his situation. And again, this is why, as we talk, this is actually a positive thing in many ways, is that, you know, our evolution has tweaked in a way that in the sperm, really what the father's genetic material that he's transmitting is set up to express traits that's going to allow the offspring to survive the trauma or the stress that the father's going through. Now, on the mother's side, a little bit different, I thought this was incredibly powerful research, is that at one point, three generations share one biological environment. So what we see, if you think about yourself, the egg that created you was created in your mom around, I think, 5 to 6 months when she was in utero in your grandmother. So the eggs that created you were actually created while your mom was in your grandmother's womb. So for about a 4-month period of time, three generations share one biological environment. And we know, and most of our listeners probably know, is that we've got a lot of documented over for years and decades now that stress hormones, as well as unfortunately substances of other kinds, can be transmitted from mother to fetus through the placenta. And we've had a lot of research in the past about the impact of cortisol and other stress hormones on fetal development. But we also see in some ways, just like the sperm transmits genetics that's going to help the kids survive the father's trauma, in many ways that same thing's happening from grandmother to, again, that three generational setup. So there's going to be a lot of impact on mom, but then a similar impact potentially on the grandchild as well. And so when we think about people in traumatic situations, dealing with the big T, small t complex trauma situations, what we see is children being born really ready to express the genetics. And I think the hope here is they don't, if we change the variables, this isn't always have to be the case. Biology is not destiny, but are really set up to survive the situations that have faced their family, sometimes for multiple generations. So that is my attempt in 10 minutes or less to sum up a whole heck of a lot of sophisticated research. So I'll throw it out to both of you to supplement that and other kind of research that you've seen coming out of this area.
Well, conceptually, I think, I mean, there's so many details to know about this. It's really kind of hard to keep track of it all. Mm-hmm. And I think conceptually what I hear is that there are essentially two types of changes that our biology can adapt to. And one is what we would call phylogenetic changes. Another would be ontogenetic changes. So there would be changes that would happen in structures across generations. And then there are changes that we can adapt to within the lifespan of an individual. And what I think is really interesting about the idea of another kind of transmission, another mechanism of transmission, is that what happens within the lifespan of the individual can cause changes in another level. So we've added another level to our understanding of how we as living systems can adapt to our environment and how we as a species can adapt to our environment. There's probably more mechanisms we don't even know about now.
Yeah,
we'll find those later, right? Yeah. So there will be plenty of those. So I think, you know, as I listen to it, I think back on some of my grad school days, and one of the things that is a wonderful overlap between the trauma-informed approach and the approach that I was trained in, which is the radical behavioral approach, mm-hmm. is that it puts it takes the causes of symptoms or problems that happen outside of the individual. So it helps us to not succumb to our urge to assign blame to things where they may not need to be assigned. And I think that's one of the good news parts of this concept, both of these concepts, that what we do is functional for our environment and what we do is functional for our species.
Yeah.
And that's what essentially is the selection process for those things, which is, you know, as we talk about all these topics, we find that we keep adding to our understanding of those things. And, you know, what I learned in graduate school 15 years ago now is there's a lot more to add to it. And yeah, like I said, trying to stay on top of all those details is really pretty difficult. So I think the concepts here are quite important of understanding how changes can be made across generations in physical structures and in our adaption to things. And certainly you can think of, a fetus that develops in the womb of a mother who is in a very stable environment may have different biology than one that is in gestation in a different environment.
Yeah.
And that those expressions can happen very, very quickly, mm-hmm. even within the lifespan of the organism. I think that's the big change for me in the tradition that I was trained in, is that this addition of another mechanism of biological change.
Yeah.
Which we kind of thought was limited to how we act and the things that we do or our behavior. That was kind of thought to be the only way that we really adapted within our lifespans. But we find that there's more than that, that our cells can change based on the experiences that we go through. Different set points can happen as we go through different experiences. And that's, you know, kind of the idea from Bruce Perry's work on the changes from what would be temporary states to become traits.
Yeah.
And you know, that's an important concept to think about as well. So those are some of the thoughts that I had from a kind of conceptual standpoint.
Great. Absolutely. And I think, boy, wasn't it easy when we were just arguing nature versus nurture?
a lot more complicated.
One or the other, somebody's going to be right, and then we can kind of move on. And holy hell, it's a boy, you know, now we've got three generations of proof. And like you said, who knows, you know, you can kind of just go back, you know, in three generations, but grandma was impacted, you know, and so the complexity of this, and I think the importance of healing also comes into focus as well. So Jerry, I know you got something to add to this, my friend.
You know, you both did a really good job of covering lots of ways in which we can change. And what I was thinking about is in the last few episodes of this, we've covered a number of ways people can change, right? So, and many of them are new ways of thinking. One is that experiences can actually stimulate the growth of new neurons in the brain, in parts of our brain, especially in the hippocampus, and grow new, from stem cells, grow new, actual new neurons. So one way to change is to grow new neurons and have experience. Another way is we change the structure and number and sensitivity of the synaptic connections between these so that these cells are picking up and more sensitive to certain signals, both in the body and in the environment, that cause it to react differently. Another way is the connections between these cells can become myelinated so that certain pathways become more efficient, more rapid, almost 3,000 times more efficient in communicating information. And so experiences can actually change the way that information is communicated within the brain and the body to respond to the environment. And now we're talking about how experiences changes the expression of DNA, right? Both in your own life experience, but also in previous experiences that gets transmitted. So that we're really talking about an incredibly adaptive species that is both our strength and our vulnerability, right? That we can change in terms of that. And I think that we know that looking at some of the history that, you know, experiences like in 1944 when the Germans were starving the people in Western Holland. Research was done two generations after that to look at the changes because the people in Holland didn't have food. The two generations later suffered with issues with obesity. Women were having low birth weight children. So that two generations after that experience, so that war not only impacts what that generation is dealing with it, but for two or three generations after. The Holocaust, with Rachel Yehuda's incredible work looking at the impact of the Holocaust on families that have PTSD, looking at that mothers who had PTSD had low cortisol levels. Their children had low cortisol levels. They were born with that. So the mother's way of adapting to her environment was passed on across to her children to kind of look at that. And that when they opened up a clinic at Mount Sinai in New York, the children of Holocaust survivors came in with PTSD symptoms, even though that they were not exposed in their lifetime to traumas.
Yeah. Right?
And so we know also from the World Trade Center, 9/11, is that women who were in 9/11 exposed to that trauma and had PTSD, their children were born with low cortisol levels. so that we have multiple scientific research outcomes that says that our capacity to adapt to our environment is going to be passed on both in maybe what we pay attention to and what we find relevant in our cultural and responsive, but also in our biology.
Yeah.
And it gets passed on.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to kind of highlight a study that was done in New Zealand in which they looked at the genes for serotonin that is involved with issues of affect regulation, anxiety, a number of anger management, a number of psychiatric disorders are tied into these genes. And what they found in this group in New Zealand was that serotonin has really two ways of, the genes have two ways of expressing itself in the human DNA. And one of those is a short form and one is a long form. So you can have two short forms, or you can have a short and a long form, or you can have two long forms. And what they found was that the short allele is less efficient in terms of transcription from, from DNA to RNA to actually the creation of protein, and that long forms is more efficient. So the people with the short form were way more vulnerable to stress later on in their lives. Yeah. However, in order to express that, these individuals had to be exposed to maltreatment. So people who had the short form who had good early childcare rearing and families did not have any, whether you had long or short. Mm-hmm. So that the genetic changes that happen transgenerationally is not our destiny based on the experiences we have in this lifetime.
Yeah.
So what that tells us is exactly what you kind of highlighted, was that our genes are not our destiny.
Yeah.
Our genes create certain resiliencies or vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. but the experiences we're exposed to or later expose ourselves to can actually have great impact on whether those vulnerabilities are expressed or whether in some ways they become our strengths.
Yeah.
So I think that your point was some of this could be really scary, thinking that, oh my God, I have to live with the trauma of my past generation.
Yeah.
Is that it's the same of a past generation as this. For some people, because I'm aware of the trauma that my family went through, or that maybe I went through, that I can create a new narrative and have new behavior and change the expression for generations to come.
Absolutely.
That's really a positive outcome of some of the stuff we're talking about today.
Absolutely. And one of the things that as I, you know, trauma, there's this historical context, and I'm always fascinated with trauma, especially when we get into the kind of our thinking about labeling it a disorder or post-traumatic stress, you know, all the illnesses, all these things, is looking at us as historical beings. And if you look at us even back, you know, maybe 10 generations or earlier, and in some places of the world, and even in our own culture, this still can be a factor, is our reality was our parents' reality. I mean, most of us, if you look back at tradition, you know, before a few hundred years ago, we were all, you know, if you won the lottery of birth, you may have been a noble, and, you know, you may have been royalty, but that was like a very small percent of the population. The rest of us were serfs or slaves or indentured servants, basically living a crappy existence with a lot of trauma in it. It was a very violent culture, even though I think you look at the news today and it can make us feel unsafe. The reality is we're still living in the safest time, really, in human history. Even with everything going on, the likelihood that one of us will be hurt by violence from another person is actually really low historically. So when I was born ready to face the trauma of my parents and the stress of my parents, which for most of us was everyday life, that was a real positive thing. That there wasn't the idea that someone born into extreme poverty could go to Harvard. And again, we can talk about all the social barriers that you know, prevents that from happening and takes away those opportunities for people born in poverty versus wealth. But the fact that it's a possibility is something very different than our historical context. So it's one of those things with trauma of, you know, historically, that's why I like to call this more intergenerational resiliency, because being born to express the genetics that let me survive or thrive in my ancestors' situation is a real positive thing. I feel like, or one of the things that I really think about with this, another real hot topic right now in our society is the experience of African Americans and how, you know, we look back three generations and you know, it's always, I always have to remind myself the Civil War wasn't that long ago historically. And how, you know, even once the Civil War ended, it didn't mean that the Black experience in America got positive all of a sudden. And we're in these historical patterns that have really allowed us to survive some really difficult situations. And so, you know, I think when I think about intergenerational resiliency, intergenerational trauma, if we can help people heal, both really from the historical thing, and a lot of that is setting up really our society in different ways. It's getting help to struggling parents as soon as possible. Those early interventions, addressing the racism, the economic and inequalities in our society really become very, very front in my thinking when we talk about the risk of this epigenetic expression, setting people up to potentially struggle. Again, we give them the right resources, we set the environment differently, and the outcomes can be incredibly different. But it just, that historical perspective really says, okay, this was a very adaptive thing that now, unfortunately, can set people up to really struggle.
You know, one of the thoughts I had, I kind of pose a question to you both, is some of the feedback about even the trauma-informed approach to individuals who have experienced trauma, is that it can at times come across like it doesn't pay tribute to the strength that it requires to recover.
Yeah.
And I think that isn't true. I mean, I think that's not intended by the approach or by people who describe the approach, but it certainly can come across that way from folks that I've heard. I wonder if either of you have heard that from people, or maybe it's just the way that I say it that gets that feedback, you know? But I think that's one of the things I think about, that like, where do we put the, or assign the value to what has happened to somebody, and then what did they do to overcome it? Mm-hmm. And so I think how we assign essentially it's assigning credit to things or putting some value to overcoming things. And I wonder if we miss that point sometimes in our discussions about trauma and recovery and the impact of our experiences on our biology and on our behavior. I wonder if we ought to do that better, or if there's something that we should say differently in that way. Any thoughts that either of you have about that or have heard that before?
Yes, heard a lot. And, you know, when we wanted to learn about our anatomy, we go and we study somebody who has a certain disease, and we study that disease to kind of understand how that part of the body works and what goes on, right? Because we can't just open people up and look at their insides. So we oftentimes get focused initially on what's going wrong as a way of studying it, you know, looking at the brain. Most people come into studies because they had some kind of brain injury, and then we say, what kind of function was lost? Really, the goal really is, ultimately is, if experiences can have a negative effect, what are the experiences we need to be exposed with enough repetition to have a positive effect? So trauma-informed should inform us about how to be more building more resilience and more growth in people to kind of look at that. So I think your point is well taken, and it's a developmental process that we're in, that we initially look at trauma and then we have to find out, so how do we flip that over and provide the relational experiences that are going to help this individual express their potential.
Yeah.
But I had another thought that came up, Matt, as you were talking, and one of them was that you mentioned that we're in the safest time in history.
Yeah.
And yet, I would bet that we feel like we're in the least safest time in history.
I would totally agree with that.
And I wonder if there's some relationship between the fact that we live in the smallest family units ever in history and are less connected as a clan than any other time in our history on the planet. Mm-hmm. And that in itself creates an increased sense of vulnerability. So that our inexperience, the way we connect is through media to do it, but really actually relational, number of relational connections is less now than any other time. And so is there some relationship between the number of relational connections you have and your internal sense of safety? Mm. And so I think it's a really important question as we look culturally, is when we move towards what we think are what we achieve as our sense of success, creates anxiety, survival anxiety in us. It makes us feel, so we need to do more and more as opposed to really going about it, creating this kind of community and relational connections that in the long term make us feel more safe, more secure, and function more optimally.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, you know, both hearing what you said and Kurt said, I think, you know, talks about the, to me, some of these two dynamics, because one is, you know, and I think, and it sounds like it could be a potential weakness of human beings, and we all live in the Rocky Mountain West where we're all supposed to be libertarians and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. I'm still not sure what a bootstrap is, but we're supposed to pull ourselves up by it, whatever it is. And, you know, one of the things that we need, and this is why I love to look at the history as well, because I think there's so many lessons there. But if you look, you know, Joseph Campbell did a lot of work with the hero's journey, is the strongest people like Hercules or all these, you know, even if you look at Jesus or Buddha, in their trauma, someone came in to help them. And so there's this deep connection. Joseph Campbell called it the mentor, or which translates into the finder of the mind. And so, you know, even historically, we knew we needed other deep relationships. We needed the Yodas of the world to come in to help us out when we got into those dark areas. And then there's that community response as well, Jerry, which I think you speak about too, is because, you know, I would argue that we probably are more connected in some ways than ever before. I have, I think, 4,500 LinkedIn connections. Who else, what other time in history did it, was anybody connected to 4,500 other people? But even though I love you, LinkedIn connections, the relationship with most of those people is not deep much at all. I'm not sure if anybody ever checks their LinkedIn account for most part, you know, and so in some ways we're hyper connected, and through that hyper connection, which is why I struggle with things like Facebook, we get these kind of hyper aroused responses, is, you know, my side and yelling at your side and your side yelling at my side. But we miss those deep opportunities. So I kind of wonder if we know part of post-traumatic growth experience as as being human is our need to connect deeply with other people as part of our post-traumatic growth experience. And again, to reset that intergenerational epigenetic expression. And yet our social groups, even though we maybe have a wider connection, those connections aren't as deep. So how do I know if a Facebook friend needs me in a deeper way, right? Because everybody's hyper aroused and dysregulated on Facebook most of the time. And so, you know, again, I think the lack of depth of relationship disconnects us from each other. And that's where I get, you know, why I think, and with my work in homelessness, is why we can look at the person on the street and pass tremendous judgment on that. Because before in human history, there seemed to be communities were either divided or in some ways created around about 120 people. Because that's sort of how many people you could sort of know personally, and that promoted your survival. So, you know, if that person out on the street is not in my immediate network or somebody I come in contact with, it's really easy to say there's really something wrong with that person. And beyond me, he's not part of my group. And so I think, again, when we look at historically, our biology is really well set up to thrive in smaller, tighter communities. And our modern society has lost a lot of that. And
well, that question is an interesting one, right? So if we take the idea that our biology is still catching up to what happened, the way that our culture was 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago, then we're talking about epigenetic changes and changes within the lifespan of the individual in our biology. And why haven't we caught up?
Haven't caught up. We still have the same brain.
What is the structure there that
preventing? So think about the Las Vegas. Let me let me throw that out there as, and let me use an example, an old timey example. Let's go back to early on in our development, because our brains were in many ways structured on those savannas of Africa where we developed as a species. And so the three of us are walking along, you know, maybe going for a hunt, trying to gather something, maybe looking for a hot mate or whatever we're doing at the time. And we see the bushes rumble, and all of a sudden a saber-toothed tiger jumps out and eats Jerry, right? And we may try to fight, depending on if Jerry's annoying us or not. We may try to fight for Jerry, but you know, what are we going to do against the saber-toothed tiger? So we watch Jerry get eaten. That's traumatic for Kurt and I. And then we go back into the tribe, and we talk about how the bushes moved, and the tiger came out, and it ate Uncle Jerry up. And of course, we tried to fight off the tiger, but it was too late to save Jerry. So we get a lesson from that traumatic experience. So the next time I see the bush shake, we know Kurt and I, and probably everybody we've communicated the story to, is going to run the opposite direction. Now, there might be something really great behind that bush, but our brains are programmed to run away or to fear that thing. So again, trauma historically has been such a lesson. And I then you take that into the context of something like Vegas. And what do we learn from that experience? And I think that our lack of ability to sort of sit with each other and talk with each other about this, Facebook is not the venue to do that, obviously. You know, what that takes away from us to learn and as part of that to really heal. And so do we kind of carry around that vicarious trauma in some way? Is every time I see a guy arguing that, hey, we need automatic assault rifles in our community to keep each other safe, that person is that bush rustling and I need to run away or fight that person. And so I think, again, we put this, you know, in many ways, this brilliant brain, I don't want to call it primitive, but again, it's really well adapted to survive what our communities have been throughout 99% of human history. And now we've got things like email and Facebook and, you know, most of human history, something like traumatic, like Vegas could have happened. I may have never heard about it being in Colorado because the news didn't travel that far. So, you know, again, we've got this brain in a different environment than it was developed to do. The good thing is we're incredibly adaptive, so we can adapt to it. But I think it sets up a lot of the challenges when we look at our brain from a historical perspective.
So, God, we go all over the place. Great. We've been to Vegas. We've been to Savannahs in Africa. But what's coming to my mind is Stephen Porges talks about neural exercise and talks about missed opportunities for neural exercise, and that our brains are designed to change and grow in the context of relationships, in that reading each other's facial expressions, tone of voice, gestures, physical proximity, that we are, our survival has depended on us being in social groups, as you talked about, for years. Mm-hmm. So when we give a child an iPod, right, or an iPad that they disconnect and they go off into their own world, they're getting information and they're getting stimulation, but it's not a neural exercise in terms of developing that brain. And so in some ways, I don't want to communicate that there's not a role and an important function for some of these technological advances that we can access information and solve problems and doing it. But we don't want it to be at the expense of close interpersonal connections that serve children in schools, in our communities, as neural exercises that allows our brain to grow and function in a way that fosters social engagement, right? And so that's really, when I'm socially engaged, when I'm connected to you, you're no longer an object. So I have a harder time walking over you or hurting you because I'm engaged in a relationship with you. But if you're this two-dimensional object and I'm enraged, really, there's very little that's going to stop my kind of aggressive impulses to kind of act out on that piece. So it's almost like you're not part of my clan, you're part of another clan, and I can go and kill you as long as I'm taking care of my clan. So absolutely. I think that really we've got to look at how do we balance as the elders of a society regulating the use of technology and doing it, and with the continuing interactional process that's going to help our children feel safe, feel connected, and actually be able to cooperatively live in social groups without, in some ways. And that's the balance we have as a culture, as changes happen so rapidly. Yeah. We've got to make conscious decisions as opposed to letting the marketplace push where we want to go.
Absolutely. And I think that as we kind of start to wrap this really huge topic again up, we don't tackle small things on this podcast. I think what we talked about, it's like I said, intergenerational trauma to me is a call that we have to take care of each other, or we set up future generations. And hey, even if you want to blame the parent all you want, which I've got a lot of arguments why we shouldn't do that, these are a kid being born. And if this kid is given the right mix of resources and support, even if their parents might struggle to give that to them, but as a society, we give that to them, they don't have to express this epigenetics that could lead to struggles in school, could lead to struggles with a down the line criminal justice or this, that, or the other. And I think it's one of the real powerful things about intergenerational trauma is that we can help folks heal the trauma of their ancestors as well. And that to me is like, oh, that's the cool thing of this, is that this trauma might have been passed down from generations and impacting people in ways that are totally unconscious to them and anybody around them. And yet at the same time, if we set up, again, the right kind of support, the right kind of society, which I think is the key thing as well, and the right resources, that this person can heal the trauma of their ancestors. And that to me is really cool.
Right. So I want to end, because I'll get to my question in a second.
Yes.
But one of the things that I am cautious about is talking about this may make some parents really anxious about what do I need to do to protect my child?
Yeah.
Right? To kind of look at that. And what I want to communicate is that our biology has the ability to change and adapt to certain experiences. But a mother's biology actually in the second trimester develops an enzyme in her body that actually protects the infant from the cortisol in her body. And that even at a biological level, mothers begin to protect their children in the womb. And so it isn't so much that if I go out and somebody robs me on the street, that my child's going to be damaged for multiple generations.
Right?
Is that we have the ability both to adapt, but also to protect from a biological level. And I think that's really important to understand. Because we could get so stressed that our worrying about being protective of our child is actually the most stress we're under.
Yeah.
So trust your body. Your body is really capable of both communicating to your infant when it needs to kind of have cortisol to get activated, to increase cardiovascular functioning and muscle, but also protects it from too much cortisol. So that this is not a simple looking at this experience and kind of doing it.
Yeah.
So my question at the end of all of this is that we covered a lot of ground today. And really, to begin to look in your own life, if experiences like working with trauma can change you in ways, and connections can protect you, what is the balance in our lives between being exposed to stress and overwhelming and our efforts to find connections and relational health in our lives. And that's really the question I think we all need to do, as we, probably most of the people are listening to this are somewhat helpers, is are you balancing out the responsibility of helping others with the responsibility you have to yourself of connecting with both yourself and with others?
Absolutely. And I think especially in these times, which seems like the last few weeks, if not every day, things are happening. I think that's such a critical question, because I think just as kind of as we talked about, and there's some research that backs this up, if your parents are exposed to trauma, you might be more vulnerable. If you're working with trauma each and every day, trauma in your, you can be more vulnerable if you don't take care of yourself to trauma that happens in your own life. And I think if we're traumatized, then we lose the ability sometimes to really be that mentor, be that helper that helps people transform the pain and suffering of trauma into that beauty of post-traumatic growth. And so I think that's a great question and reminder for this week. We're going to post this at traumainformedlens.org, all one word, where you can also find the YouTube. If you want to see us in person in action, me waving my hands a lot, you can see the video there too as well. So I want to thank you guys for joining us for this episode. Again, we covered a lot here. We'll put some resources, again, Jerry's blog post, and other things there for your reading as well. So I want to thank everybody for your time, and we'll see you next week. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. See you later. Bye-bye.